Our guest is a musician, a singer, an actor, a star of stage, screen, radio, television, and the golf course. We've come to the Ironwood Country Club in Palm Desert, California to visit all these talents belonging to one superstar, Phil Harris. Phil, we're really pleased to be here today.
You forgot how to work. You left that out. No, it's nice to be here, you and Ellen. Welcome to the desert.
Oh, it's beautiful to be at the desert. Now, you spent some time in Chicago at one stage or another, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. My first trip to Chicago, I never will forget. I'm in New York, and they're booking me, Music Corporation, they're booking me, and they booked me into Chicago in the College Inn. I'm supposed to follow Ben Burney, who was a tremendous success, and he was going over to Pabst Casino during the World's Fair.
Century of Pride.
And I don't know how big this guy is, because before they brought him out to California, I think when I was at the Grove or someplace, and they put him in the Roosevelt Hotel, he laid the souffle, and then they put him in a place, another place out there, and he laid another bomb, and he went back with Yowzer, and busted everybody in the College Inn. And so they put me in to follow him, and it was like standing in front of the chief at that time. So, but anyway, I went in, and all the guys were around in those days. Big opening, you know, you had all the bands in Chicago. And I think the only thing that saved me was during the World's Fair. So I had a very pleasant engagement, and like I say, it was a tough job to follow Ben Burney, because he was the toast of the town.
Well, people have since had a tough job following you any place, because you sure opened.
Well, no. I mean, I don't think anybody's invincible, but I mean, I'm just saying, at the time, how could a guy lay an egg two places in one town and then go to the other town and be the toast? It shows you it could only happen in America, huh, Chuck?
That's absolutely right. Phil, you're a Midwesterner, right? You were born in Linton, Indiana?
I just got back. Mm-hmm. This was our 10th anniversary at Linton, Indiana. We put 7 more children through college, and this makes altogether about, we average 7 a year, and the town's only 5,000 people. Mm-hmm. We are the third largest PGA tournament, guest tournament, I guess, in the United States. We played over 500 players. And I'm very proud of the guys, because the guy that thought about it is Don Stewart, that comes from a little town called Lyons, Indiana, an optometrist. And then Ted Bishop, who runs this little golf course. Mm-hmm. And they plan the thing every year, and it just becomes bigger and bigger. And all I have to do is just walk in. Everything is all set up.
So, but it all revolves around you and your hometown.
It's put together by the friends that conceived it, and it's turned out very successful.
How long did you stay in Linton as a child before? I guess you were raised
up until I was up. I'm sure it was up until I was out of grammar school, either 11 or 12, because I started at Hume Fog High School in Nashville, and I never finished. I was there about 20 minutes.
Just 20 minutes?
That was long enough. They had a cafeteria, and, you know, it was a long tunnel walking in there. It went out on the other street and made it very simple.
Well, you were a musician. You actually played the drums, didn't you?
Well, I did until I heard Buddy Rich, Chuck. Mm-hmm. And that made me throw him away.
You thought you couldn't do as well as Buddy did.
Oh, I don't think. Well, Buddy or Krupa or those guys.
Your father was a musician, as I understand.
My father was a good clarinet player, a legitimate clarinet player. Mm-hmm. Right.
And you worked with him in the vaudeville days?
we started. My father was with circuses. He was with Hagenbeck and Wallace. He was with Ringling Brothers. He loved it under canvas. Up until the time he died, he was my band manager all the years that I was with Benny, and he still said that if it wasn't under canvas, it couldn't be any good. You know, I mean, he was a true. We went back to the repertoire, the carnival days, and like I say, the circus days. But my father just picked up a clarinet and started to play, and it was one of those things, and it's a very intricate instrument. And if you think everybody can play it, listen to Pete Fountain.
When did you first start your musical career?
When I guess I was about 5 or 6 years old. For some reason or other, I wanted to be a drummer because all you had to do in the small town that I was in is go out and play under the street lamp, you know, and collect lightning bugs and put them in the fruit jar. Now, what are you going to do with them? You know what I mean? And I'd already turned over a privy, you know, and played long-tailed fox and spin the plate and who's got the bottle and all that stuff. You know what I mean? So I just whittled out a pair of sticks and on the hard-rung tables, you know, and on with the rungs and the chairs and everything, I had a ball. I liked it.
When did you start performing professionally, and how did that come about?
When I was a kid, my mother put me in an amateur show, like they do kids today, and I guess I just showed a flair for it. Like my father, who was a coal miner, came from a little town called Beaver Dam, Kentucky, and worked in the mine every morning, 5 o'clock, down the mine, all of a sudden sees a clarinet. That's like picking up a rattlesnake, you know. You don't fool with the clarinet. You make a note on it anywhere, you know. If your nails are not clipped, you're going to squeak. You got a clinker on your hands, you know. So the same thing with me. For some reason or other, I wanted to play drums.
And when you started professionally, were you as a drummer?
I got $5 a week, yeah, in a local theater. And I had a thing like I saw silent pictures. So I got a kick out of playing. I had a woman piano player and a woman playing a fiddle with a horn on it, you know, drive you out of the room. But you got to stay there anyway, you know. They do a whole show in the afternoon, and you do one of the supper shows, the one that is a brain knocker. So I got so that I'd see a guy and he's running around the corner and the car wouldn't start, so I'd send and get a ratchet. I'd take my $5 and I'd send to Leedy, who was big then, Leedy Drums. I'd get a ratchet. Now I saw the guy directing traffic. He blew a whistle. Boom. So I'd blow the whistle when he did. And then I got a wind machine. I got everything. So the first thing you know, for my own kicks, I'm cueing the picture, which later wound up that a guy in San Francisco years ago went to Paramount and made a fortune of doing the same thing that I was doing because I was getting a kick out of it. The wind blew, he had a wind machine. And before they had talkies, this guy made a fortune by cueing pictures, the drummer, with every kind of sound, chimes, bells, and that's
all the sounds, but not the voices.
If a guy blew a whistle up on the screen, I blew a whistle, right?
Right.
That's it.
The Dixie Syncopators, was that an early group?
That was
of
after
yours?
I got to Nashville, yeah, that's five guys. That's the regular, like, five-piece Dixieland band in those days. That's when it's a lost art. There's no more bass drum.
Right.
These people put pads and they put pasteboard and they put everything. In my days, bass drum is an instrument. It's even in the symphony. You know what I mean? In my days, you had to pay bass drum. You didn't put a cardboard and tack it down or anything because we didn't have a bass. See, you got piano, you got saxophone or clarinet. You got banjo, whatever it is. You got drums, and if you're lucky, you get a trumpet, clarinet, and trombone. Seven pieces. That's Dixieland. You understand? That's the original setup. But then you had to play bass drum because bass drum's got a tone. It's got a sound. You put your foot on there and take it off, and it's an instrument. But these people now, they treat it might as well be like a cardboard box. It has no tone to it. All my life, I wanted to have a bass drum made at the same size as a timpani so I could have things on it to tune it like you do a timpani. And, you know, but I never got to it, or I don't think they've ever gotten to it yet because now you have good bass players. But in my days, the bass drum had to be a bass. It had to have a tone, otherwise you're out of gas, you know, your washboard blues or
that's
whatever
right.
it is.
Well, now where did the Dixie Syncopators perform? Where were you performing?
Around town at Ward Belmont, at the country clubs and everything. And we were right before Francis Craig. Francis Craig, who had one big record after we left. He's from Vanderbilt. He was from Vanderbilt. And after we left town and went to Honolulu, when they sent for us in Honolulu, it's a long story. Because during vacation, a lady came through Ruth Stonehouse who owed $800 or $800,000 or whatever it was. So she's a big star. She's playing the theaters. So we went with her on one-nighters. When she got to Denver, we met a guy called Ed Sawtell, the organist, who was going over to open the Prince's Theater in Honolulu. It goes a long time. So we thought, the guy said, I'll send for you. We said, yeah, send us some of that. So, but anyway, the guy really did. And it's a long story. So then we left and went to Honolulu. Mm-hmm. And we opened the Prince's Theater. And at that time, they were hanging somebody on the screen, and we're playing St. Louis Blues, and their wines are going crazy. They never heard music like that, you know. So that's what actually happened. I mean, and then it's a long story.
Who was Carol?
Carol Loeffner, that's later. That's in 1928. Mm-hmm. See, we went to Australia. There were a guy called the Phillips Brothers. In St. Kilda, and they were the biggest people outside of J.C. Williamson. J.C. Williamson could book you around the world. Mm-hmm. One of the big booking, like the Grades in England, Lewin Leslie. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, they sent this guy over. This is strange. Now, we'd played together, but you get on panics, you know what I mean. We had Remley, we had a guy named Chuck Moll, good Aldo player that I worked with for years. He came from Moscow, from Idaho. Mm-hmm. Graduated as an engineer. Good. He's dead now. They're all gone. But anyway...
Excuse me, you say Remley was with you back?
Oh, yeah. See, I first met Remley on the boat. He was a ukulele player. Drive you out of the room. Mm-hmm. Left-handed. You know, can you beat it?
Left-handed.
A ukulele, yeah. Left-handed. That'll win, won't it? So, but anyway, a hell of a guy. So we went to Australia together. Mm-hmm. It was very strange. They sent a guy over by the name of Phillips. There were four brothers that owned Luna Park and St. Kilda out of Melbourne. He came over to pick four guys. This is strange. He came over to pick four guys to augment with the Australians, because they were tremendous musicians, but they didn't know a thing about jazz. It started in our country, as mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm working one place. Loeffner's working another place. Chuck Moll is working another place, and Remley's working another place, and this guy picks the four of us, going to different places. Mm-hmm. We don't know anything about it. And he went to this booker, and that's the way we happened. So... we all go to Australia, and we spend a year in Australia. And then the guys went back, and I went with the band to Detroit. I opened the Addison Hotel with a band called Henry Alstead. There was a big band on the coast, and we got on the panic, and I got busted again. And then I went home to Nashville, and then I get a letter or a call saying that Loeffner and Remley and Chuck Moll were starting at Balboa and wanted me to come out and join them. So that's how Loeffner, and then the guy wanted me to stand in front of the band because the guy who was playing drums, I wouldn't take his place because mm-hmm. he's trying to get through USC. And I said, what the hell? I was doing pretty good. I said, mm-hmm. I don't want his place. So a guy named Pop Tudor said, well, will you stand in front of the band? I said, I hate those guys. You know, why a one and a two? You know, I mean, it's all the same tempo. Mm-hmm. The only way you're standing out there is if you're good looking, you know. So, but anyway, he talked me into it, and I started singing a couple of songs, and he was actually, I think, responsible for what little success I attained as a band leader.
Had you done any singing before that?
Oh, yeah, going to Australia. You got to sing or masturbate, uh-huh. you know. You were 21 days mm-hmm. going mm-hmm. second class on a bad ship.
So that's where it all, that the whole thing began. Well, now, did you, when you came back, And you had this...
No, I was the sideman again when I came back. And I went with Halstead to Detroit, and we got on the Panic. That's when Goldcat had the big band. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Goldcat and McKinney's Cotton Pickers. Big bands back there in those days. That's when when Music Corporation started right in through there. Benson had it first in Chicago. And then, Music Corporation started.
Was it just about this time when the Phil Harris Orchestra was developed then?
Harris Orchestra was first started in 1920, latter part of 1928. Mm-hmm. And then I went with Loeffner. That's when I stood in front of the band instead of taking the guy's place. And then we went to the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco in 29 during the crash. And we spent 29, 30, and 31. And the only reason that we stayed that long, because I'm telling you something, when that crash came, you had to duck when you walked out the door because some Dago was jumping out the window, you know. That's when it really hurt. But the only thing that saved us was Stanford, because California, all the students from California were going over to hear Anson Weeks at the Mark Hopkins. But then after I stayed there 3 years, a man by the name of Frank, who owned the Ambassador Hotel, came to the manager of the St. Francis, who was a good friend of mine, a fellow by the name of Jimmy McCabe. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy McCabe said, you should take this guy to follow Gus Arnheim. That's when they had the Rhythm Boys, see? Mm-hmm. And they're big again, you know, you're talking about following somebody. So anyway, I left Loeffner there, and I went to the Coconut Grove, and Mr. Abe Frank and I put another band together. The only ones I kept was like Remley, who was with her, some other guys. And we went in to follow Gus Arnheim and the Rhythm Boys. And thank God we made it. I mean, it turned out all right because a friend of mine, a guy named Artie Mellinger, who was in the publishing business, you know, I mean, hustling tunes, you know. He said, I have a niece that comes from Norfolk, Virginia. And he said, Phil, he said, she's quite a singer and she's absolutely beautiful. And I said, we'll bring her out. She was 16. Her name was Leah Ray. She's now married to Sonny Werblin, been married for years and has beautiful children. But I would say that she was a good 60 or 65% of what little success I attained as a band leader.
You did some, while you were at the Coconut Grove, you started getting into radio then, didn't you? Some broadcasting.
Oh, well, we did radio. Mm-hmm. I did radio back from the Cat Whisker thing.
With all of these other groups and bands.
Oh, as a sideman. In Los Angeles, we made, I forget who it was, that, I should know him, but it's been so many years ago, that we did a broadcast when they're around and used to put that thing on the, you know, a little wire that you turn and put on.
Oh, sure, on the crystal
sets. I don't know what that is. That's right. And when I was broadcasting from the St. Francis, we had the second most powerful station in the United States. There was only one that wasn't, and that was from Texas. They had Dr. Brinkley or something But other than that, KGO from San Francisco, we got letters from Alaska, from all over the United States. I forget, there were so few stations, you know what I mean, and a tremendous amount of wattage. I don't remember exactly, but
probably half a million watts or something.
We'd go on at night. Mm-hmm. We'd go on at night, and the next day I used to get baskets of mail, baskets. Because I'm talking about 1929 now, remember.
Sure. Well, people were hungry for the new thing, radio.
And well, they liked it. And during intermission, that's when I introduced Burt Williams tunes. And during intermission, we'd play a set. And then I'd get the guitar, I'd get Remley, and I'd sit down and I'd do Burt Williams tunes during the what they call the intermission. And they happened to catch on, you know.
Did the... when you were at the St. Francis, then you were at the Ambassador. You also did some work at the Wilshire bowl, didn't you?
Well, that I had a piece of. That's way later. That's after I was with Jack Benny.
Well, later on, after that. Oh, let's stay in order.
No, well, what actually happened is after I got through at the College Inn, and then Music Operation started booking me around. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an octopus. Mm-hmm. And they get you back there, and they control you. So I left them. I didn't like the way they were operating for me. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying anything against them. Mm-hmm. But then I went with Ralph Hitz, who had his own little routine. Like, for instance, there were two or three bands, and we played the New Yorker. We went from the New Yorker to the Netherlands Plaza in Cincinnati. From there to Dallas to the... come back to it in a minute. Then we went to the Roosevelt with Seymour Weiss. Then we went to Galveston for the Hollywood. So I had five, my own little thing, which kept me in business until then. I later went back with the Music Corporation. Mm-hmm.
Did you travel from coast to coast at all with the band?
What do you mean?
You know, one-nighters here and there, two, three nights?
I played a few one-nighters, mm-hmm. but not from coast to coast. Mm-hmm. I didn't fool around the East much.
You stayed mostly
I
in
never,
the West.
Yeah, the only thing after I played, I played the Waldorf. I played the Waldorf. I played the Palais Royal. I played the Pennsylvania Roof. I played the Hollywood. I took Valley's place for a while. And I also played the New Yorker. But other than that, I didn't do any one-nighters around the East, no. Then I went to Chicago, from Chicago. But every year, I used to make all the theaters, like Boston and Cincinnati mm-hmm. and all those, when I was on the 3 months off from the Benny Show. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You, I've heard a broadcast, and I can't remember now if it was from the St. Francis or probably from the Ambassador, where you were on a regular basis, and I think you used to say, this is Phil Harrison, I don't mean no harm. Wasn't that a little catch line that you used?
No, I don't. I can't remember saying that. But I used to, I guess, I don't know. I was raised in the South, you mm-hmm. know, after I left Linton. I was raised in Nashville. And I think I was a little more Southern than Ben Burney. And like I say, when he went back, mm-hmm. when he went back from Hollywood, that's when I'm not saying any. You know, I love Ben Burney. Mm-hmm. Any Jewish fella that can say yowzer and cornbread and cream gravy and make me like it can't be all bad. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Never put a bagel in there, Jack. So, but anyway... that was my racket. Mm-hmm. I was from the South, like Dinah Shore. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was just a little bit in front of Dinah, mm-hmm. and that was, that was whatever you call it. That was my bag, or whatever you say. I mean, that was my best shot. Mm-hmm. Let's put it that way.
Phil, how did you hook up with Jack Benny?
Well. In other words, I met him at the Essex House years ago, and I had my own program at the time. I was on for J. Walter Thompson. I was on with Q-Tex Nail Polish, and I was staying at the Essex House. And at that time, he and Mary were staying there, too, and we became friends because he, I think at that time, was with Clico Club or Chevrolet or somebody. And... times pass, years pass, a couple of 3 years pass, and I'm on this thing that I told you for Ralph Hitz, the New Yorker, and then mm-hmm. to New Orleans and so forth. And I get a call in New Orleans saying that Fred Allen, George, Gracie and Allen, mm-hmm. George Burns, mm-hmm. Wants you as a band leader. And so I go to Seymour, and I had a contract to... And I said, gee whiz, I got a chance to get back on the air again because I was off, with my own program. And he let me off, and 2 days before I'm supposed to leave New Orleans, I get a wire back from Music Corporation, said, don't bother, Wayne King is going to go with Burns. So I'd already asked, so I came mm-hmm. to California mm-hmm. anyway, back to California. And I'd been here a couple of days, and Jack Benny heard about it, and he invited me out to Trocadero for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
So I go out there, and he said, what program are you on this year? And I said, well, I haven't got one. He said, you're with me. That's the way it
just
happened.
Like that.
I just happened to be sitting mm-hmm. in the right spot at the right time. You know?
Well, he had, I think at that time, Johnny Green had been his
Benson.
Band leader.
He had a guy named Benson or something. Maybe Johnny Green. But I never will forget a coincidence. Mm-hmm. What was the leader's name before Green?
He
used to
work.
He used to talk about his spats. No, he talked about his spat. Well, it doesn't make anything. But anyway, I never thought that I'd be with Jack Benny. I was in New York one time at some sort of an occasion. I don't know what. We went to the men's room, and this guy was the band leader that they kidded him about his spats. I looked at him in there, and I said, what'll you take for your spats? I'd love to have those spats.
I want to talk some more with you about not only the Jack Benny radio and TV shows, but of course
you're getting a book right now.
Getting a book, right.
Yeah.
Price is Right.
That's right. No, I don't know about the price. I hope I get one of these. I'm sitting here mm-hmm. with my two friends, with Al DeMeritt, Jimmy DeMeritt's brother, whom is very close to me here, and also Randy Carmichael. And Randy does my benefit every year back at the college I was telling you about, or I mean the thing we do in Linton. And I'm very happy to have him here with me. So anything you want to know about him or whatever you want to know, all I want you to do, I'm kind of having fun doing this, Chuck, because I would like to have it to send to my little library that Alice and I have mm-hmm. in Lenton, and let them put it away. Like I say, it's darn near a book, you know.
Well, we're gonna turn the chapter and continue with the book in just a moment. Chuck Shaden is here with our very special guest, Phil Harris. Stick around and don't touch that dial. Our guest is Phil Harris, and we're reminiscing about his very interesting career and the good old days. And we're about to talk about the Jack Benny program. And you told us how Jack first came to you and said, you're my band leader.
No, he didn't come to me.
Well, he met you there.
I mean, we were invited to mm-hmm. dinner, and we were sitting there, and he wasn't even aware that I didn't have the program mm-hmm. that I had when we were staying together. I mean, when we were both living at the Essex house. And like I say, I was terribly disappointed because I had brought the band all the way from New Orleans and found mm-hmm. out that they're using Wayne King instead of me on the Burn Show. And I don't even think that Jack was even aware of that. If he was, I never found mm-hmm. out about it. And I spent 16 or 17 of the most beautiful years of my life with him. A man who was one of a kind.
I think everyone would agree with you.
Well, what the hell, he proved that.
Did he come to you when you got together, when he said, okay, he found out you were free and he wanted you for his show? Did he say, all right, now my lawyer will get in touch with your lawyer and we'll sign these contracts and we'll do all of this stuff? Or how did your association begin formally?
Well, yeah, he had a manager.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I probably, Minna Wallace was my manager for years. That's Al Wallace's sister,
mm-hmm.
who only handled three people that I know of, and Gable was the other one, and George Brent was the other one.
Mm.
So I was pretty well established, mm-hmm. too. So I don't think we had any problem. And he was exactly opposite of what he portrayed.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he was very, very generous. And his biggest asset on the air was being tight, you know.
Yes.
But he was exactly opposite. Otherwise, like he came to me one time and he said, Phil, when he used to cue, you know, me drinking and all this, mm-hmm. he said, you keep drinking like that, it won't be funny anymore. You understand
mm-hmm.
what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that was the same way. He was identically opposite. He used to come to me maybe every 4 or 5 months and say, go to so-and-so and get yourself some more money. I said, look, I'm getting plenty. All I'm saying is, hello, Mary, here comes Rochester, you know. I could phone it in. You know what I mean? He says, go tell him to give you some more money. Beautiful man.
The value of what you did to this program.
No, he was a beautiful man. Mm-hmm. What the hell? You know, anybody wanted to go to work with Benny.
Mm-hmm.
You
were actually conducting the band on his show for all those years that you were with him?
That's right.
So you had more to do than just... just reading the lines. But
it wasn't hard because after Whatcom left, J-E-L-L-O, mm-hmm. they had a little trouble with that or something, and I wrote, ba da 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 da, you're a Yankee Doodle mm-hmm. Dandy. Ba da 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 dee da 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 dee da 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 da. That's all there was. Every week is the same thing. The only thing is I had a special arranger for Dennis Day to mm-hmm. do the ballad. And then the only other things were little 8-bar phrases to break up the sequences. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
But there was a time when you would you and the band would perform a number within the
very
show.
Very seldom.
Too.
No.
Play
no.
Phil, I know he used to.
Oh well, Play Phil was when they said like for Dennis. Mm-hmm. They didn't say who was directing Dennis. Mm-hmm. You know. But no, I very seldom. I had one that they talked about a lot was when he analyzed "That's What I Like About the South."
Yes, uh-huh.
But I think that was on television. See, I only worked with him, I think, once or twice when he went into television. Mm-hmm. I didn't go.
Was there any reason for that?
No reason, no. I was doing all right myself.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had...
I had my own show... Mm-hmm. Yeah. To show you what kind of a man Jack Benny was, mm-hmm. Jack Benny let me do comedy exactly right following him.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine what I had going in, what kind of account I had going in. I had the highest rating in the world going in, the best rating.
Absolutely.
And I'm doing comedy. That's how beautiful. You know, I have two daughters. I mean, I'm doing a different type of comedy, you know, Alice and myself. But I mean, what other guy? And then I'm running through the alley after they go to CBS. I'm running through the alley to warm my audience up. Mm-hmm. And he's letting me off the first 15. He puts me on the first 15 minutes mm-hmm. so that I can go get out of there and go and start my own show. That's a pretty nice guy, isn't it?
I would say. Sure. He was doing it. You were both at NBC initially.
And then mm-hmm. he went to CBS.
Then he went over to CBS, was a couple blocks
down. And it's a block
down.
Away.
Yeah.
A block and a half away. And
you would know.
I used to run through the alley. That's right.
And he'd let you get away.
First 15 minutes, he put me on and then let me fly in there mm-hmm. so I could warm up my audience at NBC.
It was incredible.
Never been done before.
No.
Never
no.
again.
It was incredible that he
was a beautiful man.
Yeah. Let Dennis Day do the same kind of thing, didn't he?
Although well,
it wasn't
Dennis
back
Day
to back.
Didn't conflict that yeah. That obvious, you know.
You were that was really almost a spin-off as you went, because I think you met.
I was 7 years on my own program yeah. with Alice, yeah. I'd say my own. And I think 4 or 5 of those, I was on Jack's mm-hmm. too, mm-hmm. same time. Mm-hmm. Never be done again. The same thing as if you stop to look at it, you couldn't go to a theater on Sunday unless the theater manager promised to stop the picture and let you hear the Jack Benny program.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't go to theater. They wouldn't go to theater on Sunday.
You started your own show on the Fitch. It was the Fitch Bandwagon.
I played the Fitch Bandwagon, and then from there, that's mm-hmm. when I went.
Were you?
I took Cass Daly's place.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Were you playing the Bandwagon strictly?
That's
the
band.
Orchestra,
they
right?
put the bands band. On. That's uh-huh. all. You played tunes. You know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. And how did that come about? Did they come to you just as the band leader and say, hey, we want you on the band?
No, they were, don't you remember?
I'm asking
They were putting on all kind of bands.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Every week.
Fitch Bandwagon had a different
band.
So,
well, what the hell? They ran out of people, so they called on me, you know.
But then,
no, they used the band every week.
Yeah, but how did it change to the comedy?
What do you mean?
To Phil Harris and Alice Faye.
Well, Christ, I've been on with Jack Benny. Uh-huh. I'm saying pretty funny things mm-hmm. then, I think.
Yeah. Sure.
And but Alice Faye had been around a little bit. You know, she'd been a star for 100 years mm-hmm. at the century, so 20th century. So you mean where did we lose it? That's what you're trying to say. What happened to it?
No, I'm trying to say,
who
came up with the idea?
We always had it.
A situation.
We
want to
know how we lost it. That's what we want. What do you mean, situation comedy?
To do the situation comedy.
Well, everybody was doing situation comedy. Oh, Fitch, and they wanted to try that.
They wanted to try
that. Because they tried all the band leaders, and then they had, like Cass Daly was doing comedy,
right.
Slapstick comedy. Mm-hmm. So then they wanted to go back to a family show, I guess.
And that's where you guys came in.
That's where Julius Abruzzo and all the Frankie Remley, who was somebody else, was playing all those things.
Yeah, no, well, that was...
Elliot Lewis.
Elliot Lewis was...
Was Remley. That's
Remley
right.
On that. Now, I want to tell you, I had a chance to talk to Elliot Lewis one time, and I mentioned this to him, and I would like to tell you, too, that I think that you and Elliot, as Phil and Remley, were to radio what Laurel and Hardy were to the movies and maybe what Gleason and Carney were to television, because you two guys worked so well together. You were just an absolutely perfect team.
I appreciate it, because, you know, I've always thought the same way. And I'll tell you something else about Elliot Lewis. He is a very astute guy. And he said at the time, and he's lived it out, that he would never work with anybody after me. And he never did. Yeah, we were like clockwork. See, he did the Mully guy and two or three things on the Benny show when I was on that show. And then when we came in, we fit together like a glove. It just, and like he said, and he had, I think, several occasions to work with other people. And he said, no, not after Phil. He said, and then he went into producing, as you know.
Well, I don't think you could top that. Some of the
it was easy. It just used
things
to flow. You know what I mean?
His timing was.
Of course, don't forget that he was a very important actor before he went with me. I mean, Benny and all the shows, as you know. I mean, you take Fibber McGee and Molly, or these guys worked every week. They did two or three characters. You know, like and. And Leonard, Leonard and those guys, you know, the tout, the guys said, hey, come in. Those guys, they worked every week, and so did Elliot. I mean, they were working on all the shows, you know, doing different characters. They were great performers, and Elliot's a good writer. He's a good producer, And you know, Leonard did all right. He later went with Lucy or somebody. Did very
Danny
well.
Danny Thomas, he did a lot of stuff with.
That's right.
Sheldon
That's right.
Ryan, yeah.
Well, those guys all came up through the ranks, you know. I mean, they knew what they were doing. Because when you're around Benny, you were around a guy that he and Fred Allen and guys like that, they're timing, you know. They're like Benny used to have office hours in Beverly Hills. Those writers had to be there, didn't they? They were there at a certain time. He sat at the table. Nobody took bits home like they do now. You do this and you two writers do. No way. You sat right at the table and started this thing. And I've been in there sometime. Jack and I, we really got along. And I've been in there sometime when they had a line for me to break the building down. And Benny would say, no. Does not fit his character. I've been too long building it up. In other words, he protected. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you hear a lot of other shows. They had a guy in the air one time. They had him doing this, doing that. First thing you know, they burn him out. When he came to me one time, he said, there's no way to kill you. I found you four stories down in the basement. I brought you out. I had you married. I had you drinking. I had two kids. I had you back on the booze again. He said, there's no way to kill you. Because, you know, people knew it wasn't true, you know. See, that was Benny's whole stock and trade. Pardon me. You had to have something that he could magnify. Mm-hmm. In other words, when after Kenny Baker left, we couldn't find a singer. Benny, Parker, he always wanted a tenor. You know, that's what Benny wanted, to fit in there. So we finally saw this picture, and we went into the Bronx, and McNulty is his real name. And I went over, and I had dinner over at his house. And his old man, we call him Tiptoes McNulty. He was rushing the can, you know, Schaefer's beer. And at the first rehearsal, Jack looked over and he said, "Dennis?" And Dennis said, "Yes, please." Well, that was it. He had to find something that he could magnify. And he magnified mine by being a ladies' man or a drinker. You know what I mean?
On the show, you were a very vain person. Hello, folks. If you're down in the dumps, you can smile because Harris is here.
Well, that actually was it, because I was a very happy guy.
Everybody would get... I can see that. Everybody would get lines that would put Jack down on his show.
Well, oh,
and
sure.
Jack loved that. That's what he was looking for.
I never will forget. He came to me one time. I don't know what I couldn't tell you what the line was, but after it was over, he came to me and he said, "Phil, do you like this job?" And I said, "I certainly do." I said, "It's the first time I've ever had a home, and the first time I don't have to go on the road." And he said, "Well, would you like to keep it?" I said, "I certainly would." He said, "Well, don't ever say anything sweet to me again." That was his line.
I've heard stories, and I don't know whether these are true or not, but that a lot of the sarcastic or the mean things that you said to Jack were taken seriously by Mary.
No,
is that a fact?
No. We had writers. I couldn't say anything I wanted to say. What the hell? You mean the writers were mad at Mary?
I don't know. It's just that's the feeling that I've gotten from a few people.
I don't know if it was politics that lasted a long time. It was a happy family.
Yeah.
But I had to do what they put down there, Chuck. You know, I mean, I wasn't making up my own routine in those days. So if the writers had anything against Mary, I don't think so.
Doubt it. How much rehearsal did you have to do for the Benny Show?
Well, we finally got it down to where it was so oiled and so beautiful and so well written before we went into rehearsal that we used to have a reading, say, like on Saturday afternoon, and then they would make the cuts or whatever it is. Then we'd start Sunday morning at 9 o'clock. We go through a rehearsal. We go back in the room. They cut it, fool with it. And we'd go through it again. And then we'd go to lunch. And we'd come back. And the first program would go on at 4. And the second one at 8:30. That's when we, before tape, before we do it for New York, and then we did it for the coast.
It was a relatively easy stint then to do that.
And the musicians were making about three times as much as they're making now. Mm-hmm. Because now everything is put on the tape, and once they got it, they got it. Mm-hmm. But these musicians in those days, for one day alone back there, a sideman, was making $90 or $100 for Sunday alone. Because we did a broadcast and then a rebroadcast, you know. One for the east and one for the coast. Mm-hmm.
Did, if you had a particularly good gag in that, or a flub maybe, in the first show.
There's no way you can fix a flub.
You can't do it again.
No way.
You wouldn't repeat
the
flub.
No way. They have tried every way in the world to make a flub and it won't work, or whatever you call it. No, you can't set one up.
In other words, if you screwed it up on the first show, you just
it won't
did it
play.
Straight the second
it won't
show.
Play.
Yeah. It comes off fake then, doesn't it?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, that's my experience. Of course, we've never tried to set up one. Mary used to make one frequently, or not frequently, infrequently. And it used to play, or we all did, you know. But I mean, as far as setting a trap, it won't work.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes I know the writers would really pick up on something that went wrong on one show, and then
well, it's like Benny. Benny had this It was the most beautiful thing in the world. Now, a gag that he got hung on years ago, I never will forget, is like a moose needs a hat rack. Now, he used that for years, and he could never get a laugh with it, but it is very funny if you stop to figure it out. And then the other one was Washington slept here. You know, he liked to never live that picture down. But he wouldn't let people forget about it, you know. Yeah. I mean,
and the hornbills at midnight, too.
His whole thing, that's right. His whole thing was he'd set up a line, and then he'd go maybe 5 or 6 minutes, and then he'd trip it, you know. Mm-hmm. And then he'd go another 5 or 6 minutes, and then he'd bang you with it again, you know.
The running gag.
That's
he
right.
was a master of it.
That's right.
I want to ask you about Frankie Remley. Now, you say he was with you from way back in the
early
days.
Well, he started when I first went to Honolulu with the band I told you about. He was in the band playing ukulele or some, I don't know what the hell he was playing, left-handed. But he was a nice guy, a beautiful guy and a beautiful personality. Good-looking guy. Came from Fargo, North Dakota. And I just took a liking to him. Mm-hmm. So then I go over to Honolulu and I spend a year. And when my band all went back to school in Nashville, I didn't want to go. So I took the first boat back to the United States after the earthquake in Japan. About 1924 or something. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to go home, so I took the President Pierce from Honolulu to San Francisco. I'd never been there before, but I didn't want to go back home. I wanted to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a pretty good drummer at the time. I mean, I could keep good time.
Mm-hmm. So Frankie,
if you told me where it is, no, I don't even know who he is then.
Oh, at this point.
You know, he's back. He's with the... he got off the boat. I don't know what the hell he's doing. So then when I come back to San Francisco, I go to work with two or three bands, and you get on the panic, and then I went to L.A., and now when I go to L.A., I meet him. He's thrown the thing away and gotten a banjo, which is worse, you know. Anytime you're playing banjo, you're the leader. Because when they start turning that thing on, you might as well leave town, because they got it made with the waterfalls on the front to boot, you know.
Well, he took a lot of ribbing as a member of your band on the Benny Show.
Who did?
Frankie Remley.
Oh, Benny loved them.
Yeah.
And they used to go on vacations during the summer. Mm-hmm. Benny used to love to drive and places and everything. He and Remley, the real Remley, were very close friends. Mm-hmm. He liked Remley. In other words, you let me use his name on my program, following him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Benny, I'll tell you something. God love him. He was one of a kind. I understand now his daughter, I just heard from his daughter, and she's doing a book.
Oh, wonderful.
And I gave her a few little things, and I remember when they brought her home from the Essex House when she was a little bitty baby, when Mary first brought her home, the daughter.
I want to talk about a second or two about your recording career as a singer. You had some pretty good songs that went... did pretty well on
special the material thing.
Special comedy material. The Thing. Boom, 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 boom,
right,
boom, boom.
Right.
That was really big.
They're doing that again. Reader's Digest are making an album, putting out an album of These Were the Days or something. Something like your thing. And they're putting that tune on The Thing. Howie Richmond published it. And that was a thing like... a lot of things that have happened with different people that record. It was a thing just to fill it up. We didn't have anything to put on that side, you know. And it was an old English sailing song or something with risque lyrics, and they cleaned the lyric up, and it became... It sold pretty good. It was over a million selling.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, you did Smoke, 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 and...
Poker Club, The Preacher and the Bear. Mm-hmm. But the best things that I ever did, we've got to close this thing down.
Mm-hmm.
the best thing that I ever did, I think, to me, doing something that I'm proud of, actually proud of, were the things that I did for Disney. Those
yes.
are, as far as I'm concerned, they had a little talent. The rest of them are, like I say, are pieces of material, like Poker Club and Preacher and the Bear and things. Smoke that cigarette. I mean, the talk things, you know. The things with Disney, they demanded a little talent, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you provided it. And you provided it for us over the years.
I was very fortunate.
I appreciate the chance to sit and visit with you, and I want to thank you on behalf of all of your fans out there for all the great stuff you did over the years. It was wonderful, and you really enriched our lives with the work you did.
Well, that's very nice, Chuck, and it's a pleasure to meet you and to meet Ellen, your wife, and I just wish that when you play this thing that you will remind your audience that I had Al DeMeritt and I had Randy Carmichael sitting at the room who I had invited for lunch today, and I hope that you will say hello to all their fans in Chicago.
We certainly will, and we're glad that they were here as part of the rooting section for our get-together. Thanks, Bill Harris.
Thank you, Chuck.